Murray's 1962 novel, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, which was set slap bang in the middle of the front lines of the Cold War. And the Cold War was perhaps a golden age for spies, and hence spy novels. The stakes couldn't have been higher than world domination or obliteration, and the agencies involved couldn't have been more cunning. But fortunately for all of us, Cold War's over. Fortunately for all of us, perhaps, apart from spy novelists and arms manufacturers, which raises two interesting questions. What should the modern spy thriller writer write about, and how is he or she influenced by the period? Now, my name's Michael Ridpath. I'm moderating today. I write about a detective called Magnus, who's an Icelander. But before that, I wrote financial thrillers. My first one was published in the early 1990s. And I suppose that was my attempt to answer the question, what do thriller writers do next? But here we have a lineup of wonderful spy thriller writers. What I'm going to do is ask each of them one question each first, and then ask some questions for all of them to answer. After that, there'll be questions for the floor and the box of books for the best questions. So I'll be looking out for that. We have here Adrian Magson, who is writing a series about a burned-out MI5 agent, Harry Tate, the latest book of which is Traces. Simon Conway, whose recent book, A Loyal Spy, is about Jonah Saeed, an ex-MI6 spy operating against Al-Qaeda and its allies. Jeremy Dunn's series features an MI6 officer, Paul Dark, and his most recent book is the second in the series, Free Country. And Rory Clements is out to prove that the spy was alive and well centuries before the Cold War. His books are set in Elizabethan England and feature John Shakespeare, who is Will's older brother. And the most recent in his series is Prince. So my first question is for Adrian. Now, Adrian was a runner-up in the Debut Dagger of 2001, and since then has tried a number of different avenues, including crime fiction, young adult fiction. He's writing a series about a French policeman, The Death in the Marais, I think, is the most recent book. And also he started this series about Harry Tate, who is a washed-up MI5 officer, the first of which was Red Station, and the second is Traces. So the most obvious question is, why did you decide to write about spies, and didn't you think their days were over now the Cold War is finished?
The first question first, I'd always wanted to write spy novels. I was brought up on the likes of, you know, Desmond Bagley and Gavin Lyle and all of those. Not Fleming so much, but I'd always wanted to write spy novels, and I'd written a series of five crime novels and decided I really wanted to change. So that was the main thing. And what was the second question? Sorry.
Well, did you think that now the Cold War is over, that you could still write about spies?
Yeah, because I don't think spies ever really went away, as has been proven by the capture of the spies in America, the Russians, and indeed a couple of our own people that were picked up in Moscow. What they did over the years, I think, was the spy novel evolved into more the sort of the general adventure novel. And they were still doing things that spies would have done or would do, but in a slightly different way. So I think they were hidden for a number of years. But, you know, as evinced by the colleagues on the panel here, they are coming back with a vengeance. So I decided, yep, now was the time.
Now on to Simon Conway. Simon served in the army before working for the Halo Trust, clearing landmines and other charities relating to all kinds of exploding devices. I think A Loyal Spy is your third book, and it won the CWA Steel Dagger for the best thriller last year. It's a classic spy novel with divided loyalties, double agents, clashes of ideologies, and it's set in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sierra Leone, the Outer Hebrides, the most exotic of all, Canary Island. And you seem to me to have pretty much substituted Al-Qaeda and its related entities for the KGB as the bad guy. When you were writing the book, were you conscious of the great tradition of spies and spying during the Cold War, or has the spying world changed and you completely forgot about, you know, the KGB versus the CIA and MI6?
I think it's a... I would say that it's a continuation of the same thing. I mean, the Cold War was really the fallout from the Second World War, and the current war on terror, the events in Afghanistan, are themselves the fallout from the Cold War, from you know, the sort of comfortable, in a sense, the détente in Western Europe. Actually, what was going on in the Cold War was all over the world. In places like Afghanistan, there were wars going on in which huge amounts of weaponry that had been stockpiled, you know, for this massive industrial war that never happened, was being offloaded on third world sort of rebel groups that were then fighting each other savagely all over the globe. So I think it's kind of an extension of the same thing, and the same kind of elements apply, of spying, of double agents. I was particularly interested in this idea of the double agent as being someone who plays both sides. There's a line in my book where the sort of grizzled spymaster Monteith says, a good double agent's not pretending, he's playing both ways, and the trick is to get the best end of the arrangement. And that's it's pretty much a paraphrase of Le Carré. So yes, I certainly did see Le Carré particularly as informing what I was doing. And I think that he actually has responded quite well to the end of the Cold War. The book set in the Caucasus particularly, I really enjoyed Our Game, mm-hmm. and Single and Single. So I definitely was informed by Cold War spying fiction. Yeah.
Now on to Jeremy Dunn's. And of course the Cold War is history now, and it must be because my daughter writes essays about it, which is a rather strange kind of feeling. And Jeremy Dunn's, I suppose, is effectively writing historical fiction. His books are set in the 1960s with flashbacks to the 1940s and feature an MI6 officer, Paul Dark, which is the same name as my electrician, strangely enough, so I'm going to get a book signed for him. He's a big, ugly guy, so I hope he's not going to be upset. His first book was Free Agent, and his second is Free Country. He's been likened to Le Carré, Fleming, Frederick Forsyth, and Len Dayton, which is a pretty good,
by my publisher,
pretty good going. but he hasn't really come in from the cold, because not only is he still writing about the Cold War, but he lives in Stockholm. but the question that occurs to me about your books is, what difference is there about writing about the Cold War now, with 40 years of hindsight, compared to those people who were writing about the Cold War at the time? Do you have a sort of better sense of perspective because you've got the historical angle, or is the research easier, or is it harder because you can't actually talk and see the people doing their spying and the other things going on?
That is the reason why I wanted to do it, was that I really, really liked and do like Cold War fiction, but it was a chance to do something that wouldn't have been, you wouldn't have been able to write the books I'm writing during the Cold War. First of all, because my agent, Paul Dark, named after your electrician, is a traitor. He's an MI6 agent, but he's secretly been working for the KGB for most of his adult life. And I think during the 60s, while the Cold War was going on, that would have been quite difficult for British. I mean, there are double agent thrillers, but I think it would have been a bit of a harder sell. But I think also just the history of the Cold War is changing every day as new documents come out. And I think what Simon said is absolutely right, that it's also what's going on now is a continuation of the Cold War. I don't really think the Cold War has finished. I think it's morphed into something else. Yeah. Just exactly as you said, the Second World War morphed into the Cold War, morphed into where we are now. And it's the same agencies doing the same stuff. Maybe not quite as overtly or quite as obviously as beforehand. But I think, to answer your question, there's an enormous amount of memoirs, declassified documents, and we know a lot more about the Cold War now than while it was going on. On the other hand, there's an astonishing amount that we don't know. I'm constantly changing what I'm writing. The book that I've just finished writing, I'm having to go back and change lots of things because there have been documents that have been declassified in the last sort of 3 months that have said, well, actually, that's not what happened. That was all, you know, misinformation. this is what really happened. And so there's some quite major stuff that I think that is still not really known about the Cold War, and I find that quite fascinating, that it's recent history that is still evolving.
So that's and so happened. When you read these old novels written by, you know, John le Carré and so on, do you spot mistakes in them?
Well, I mean, I don't think John le Carré really makes very many mistakes, to be honest. But I think it's more in terms of there's a lot of guesswork, a lot of conspiracy theory,
right.
You know, and a lot of them got it right or close to right. But there are some spy novels that you read where you think, well, that theory was wrong.
Right.
You know, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but yeah, I think there have been ideas about the Cold War have been proven wrong. You know,
right.
In fiction, yes.
So now we come to a completely different way of writing about spies. Rory Clements is a journalist who escaped Fleet Street for Norfolk and current affairs for 16th century England. His three books so far are Martyr, Revenger and The Forthcoming Prince. And Revenger won the Ellis Peters Award for Historical Fiction last year, so there's a whole line of daggers next to me. His hero, John Shakespeare, works for the spy services run by Walsingham and then by Robert Cecil. It's occurred to me that the Cold War has had such an effect on our perception of what a spy is, and obviously there have been spies for centuries beforehand. Has the perception of the Cold War coloured your own description of spying in Elizabethan England, or were you able to stand back and look at it differently, or was spying then completely different than it's been in the 20th century?
Well, the difference is that there was no electronics then,
right.
No electronic surveillance. But I think in many ways it's much the same. It's certainly coloured by what I've read. I was hooked on James Bond,
right?
As I think most people were hooked on John Buchan as well,
mm-hmm.
and Freddie Forsyth in his early days. Certainly, absolutely terrific stuff. And
has that come through in your own writing about?
I hope
Elizabeth
so.
England?
If I can do it the way they did it, I'd be delighted. But certainly the time I'm writing about it was mostly hot war,
right.
Because I started 1587 when we were at war with Spain. But Walsingham had set up his network during the Cold War before that, and the Cold War went on quite a few years. And he was well aware that Spain and the Catholic underground in England posed what he saw as a great threat to the country, and he decided to employ the methods used by his enemies. I mean, he used blackmail and bribery, he used forgery, he used assassination, and what he certainly would have done, he would have happily have had Mary Queen of Scots murdered in her bed rather than having to take her to trial. He worked many years for her towards her death, and he set up an astonishing network of spies throughout Europe, every capital, even as far as Turkey and beyond. Even in America, he had, you know, South America, he had spies. He had spies in the Armada. It was an astonishing network he had.
Were they motivated by money or loyalty?
A lot of them were motivated by money. A lot of them were dregs of society who did dirty deeds for him. Yeah.
Right.
But a lot of them were what we now know as diplomats.
Same people.
Yeah. Simon, I was interested on your website, you were talking about the gunpowder plot in 1605 as an inspiration for the bashing Al-Qaeda. How does that work?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about the gunpowder plot is that the conspiracy was probably discovered by the intelligence services pretty early on. And they let it run, and they let it run right up to the point where they arrested Guy Fawkes, because that then allowed them this massive backlash against Catholics, and allowed the intelligence services themselves became stronger. And you can see parallels with So if I look at modern instances of that, you could say the rise of the FSB in Russia now, the way in which they will use events like Chechen terror attacks, which may or may not even have been bombs that may or may not have been left by Chechens, is used by the FSB as a means of consolidating their power. So I suppose I had this idea at the back of my brain there's a common thread here about intelligence services using plots as a means of stirring up the public, as a means of consolidating their own power. So when I was writing The Loyal Spy, I certainly had the gunpowder plot in mind. And the other interesting thing actually about the gunpowder plot is that the plotters were housed, were hidden by often by widows as they travelled across Britain, because Catholic widows, it was very difficult for the state to seize land from widows. So if you were a man and you refused to convert, they could seize your land. But if you were a widow, you, because you didn't really have any status in the law, it became much more difficult for the state to seize your land. So there was this network of Catholic widows who actually hid the plotters as they travelled. So Miranda, one of the characters in A Loyal Spy, is hidden by a series of women as a fugitive as she travels across Britain in one of the threads of the book. Mm. So there were a couple of ways in which the plot influenced my plot.
So it sounds very unlikely, but it's true. You can see the parallels. So if spy thrillers in the Cold War, there are obviously many different thriller writers in the 60s and 70s, and we think of perhaps John le Carré at one end, the sort of cerebral chess game, and Ian Fleming and James Bond at the other end. There's a kind of continuum in between. Perhaps if I could ask you, Adrian, where does your guy Harry come in that sort of the continuum between Smiley and James Bond? And where's the best place to be?
I think, well, for Harry Tate, he's sort of at the scruffy end of the le Carré thing. He's not the all-action James Bond type, but he does have what my wife and I refer to as the MacGyver moments, where he does actually take a gun out because he really gets peed off with what's going on. But he's the sort of, you mentioned he was a burnt out MI5 officer, and he's more burnt than burnt out because he's actually betrayed, but he still retains his links. And MI5, like MI6 now, have a much broader scope of activities than they used to have. So they're fighting serious crime, they're fighting terrorism, they're fighting drugs and all of that. So it's given me a huge amount of leeway to keep Harry involved with MI5, even though they betrayed him. Mm. So he's a kind of freelancer, but he's using the skills he picked up, fighting drugs, fighting terrorism. So he's at that end. He's loyal, has always been loyal, in spite of the fact that he's betrayed by his bosses and nearly killed. He's got that umbilical cord which holds him, and what really drives him forward. But he's no longer the sort of the good dog that he used to be.
Mm.
So he's gone a little bit wild. So I would say that he's down at that end of the, right, the le Carré end.
When you find yourself writing, I mean, he does get involved in some action, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, he has to. Yes.
And then when you find yourself writing that, do you enjoy doing it? Do you think, you know, you feel like shooting some people up this morning, or or is it more? Or do you feel a bit self-conscious? Say, well, we need to be some action now. I've got to kind of wake up and write something.
Somebody's got to die, yes. I mean, I get to a point where he's done all the cerebral stuff and the thinking, and it gets to a stage where, yeah, get the gun out, guy. You know, so he unlocks the lockbox in the back of his car and away he goes. Because he's carded, effectively. It means he's not a member of the military, although he used to be, but he's now carded, which means he's allowed to carry a weapon.
Hmm.
But he's on call, should he ever be needed.
Is that real, or did he make that up? Does that happen, do you know?
Well, it was. I don't know whether it still is, to be honest, but it was. They were actually, in fact, Simon would probably know more about it than I would, but they were the guys that were kept on, and they are now. I mean, the ex-special services are used for certain jobs. Whether they're called carded or not now, I don't know.
Right.
They may have a different kind of terminology for it.
Privatised a lot of it.
It's
very murky.
Yeah, PMCs now, yeah. But, yeah, Harry isn't a PMC, private contractor, but he's as close as he could get, yeah.
Well, Paul Dark, obviously my electrician, is carded. I didn't know that about him. I'll be very careful when next time he comes to change light bulbs. Where do you think, Jeremy, he lies on the sort of James Bond to Smiley range?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm a huge James Bond fan. I'm a kind of James Bond nut, really. So Ian Fleming was an enormous influence. But the background, I think Paul Dark, I said this in another panel, but I mean the basic premise of him is, it was from the start, influenced by the whole Cambridge ring of Kim Philby and Burgess and McLean, and just thinking how, and that sort of Smiley territory of moles and all that stuff, and just thinking if you mix that with James Bond, which doesn't really have that in it very much, although it's mentioned a couple of times, what would happen if you merged those two? So what if James Bond had, like Kim Philby, actually been a KGB agent all along? That's basically the premise of it. So in a way, I'm using the background of le Carré, the Carré's world of mole hunts and of the sort of real SIS and the real kind of bureaucracy and politicking of a Cold War, with lots of sort of people with manila folders sort of plotting, you know, in offices with very sparse furniture. And then in the foreground you have the character who's much more action-driven and much more, Bond and also Quiller and people like that. So I'm sort of merging different strands, I think, hopefully in a reasonably coherent way of the genre.
And is that perhaps because sort of 30 years on from when these books were written, you're able to absorb all of it and mix it up in a way at the time?
Yeah,
might have been harder.
Maybe. I mean, I've read an awful lot of Bond fiction, so maybe it's just a kind of sum of... I suppose I basically just read an awful lot of spy thrillers and watched a lot of spy thrillers and kind of took what, you know, sort of absorbed what I liked and what I wanted to do. So, yeah, so it's influenced by lots of different strands of it, I guess, yeah. I have that, as you say, it's 30 years of it, so I have that luxury that I can pick which bits of the genre I like, yeah.
And Rory, how about John Shakespeare? Is he a man of action or a... Potter and Planner.
Action when necessary, but he does have qualms. He's not as callous, I don't think, as James Bond. He lives in a world where torture is rife, and he doesn't like it.
Right.
But he has to live with it because he dislikes the enemy even more, and he realizes that if he isn't doing the work that he's doing, it'll be left to less scrupulous people, the likes of Richard Topcliffe, who was a very real and very foul villain, and was licensed to torture and execute directly from the Queen, and he was Walsingham's man. So, you know, he fits very much into the idea that, you know, if all that's needed for you know, evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. So he has to do something or leave it to the rest. But, he's a man of action when necessary. Right. He doesn't go around killing people wholesale.
Yeah, how is he armed in Elizabethan England? Does he have a dagger with him at all times?
He carries a dagger and a sword all the time, right. But he doesn't tend to use them. He'll use a gun when necessary. Guns were more prevalent than swords. It was a sword play in those days, despite Errol Flynn.
Right.
I like License to Torture. That would be an alternative James Bond novel.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? The concept of good and bad, I think, is important in any thriller. Most thrillers are sort of morality tales. And there's a strong argument that the hero in a thriller should have flaws. And I think none of your heroes would be sort of an English schoolboy of the 1950s wouldn't think these are patriotic Englishmen at all. I mean, but on the other hand, it can be quite difficult because... how do you create sympathy for characters who torture, kill, and change sides? So it's a sort of question of making interesting, complicated heroes against, unsympathetic ones. I mean, Jonas has his good points and his bad points. He's the man in Loyal Spy. I mean, did you worry about making him sympathetic, or is he good? Is he good or is he bad?
I think he's basically good. I mean, he's an interest, or what I tried to do was create someone that could operate in a world of, you know, that could slip in and out of Afghanistan and the tribal areas of Pakistan and Iraq or whatever. So his father is a Palestinian scientist. His mother is a Guyanan barrister. In many ways, they're sort of pillars of the community, but they're also exiles from their own countries that have settled here in Britain. And he's sort of disparaging. Described as mulatto flotsam at one point, as are the sort of the collection of misfits that make up the Afghan Guides, this undercover group of spies that have been operating in Afghanistan since the Mujahideen time. But he's definitely got problems. He's quite brutal, I would say. But there's a sort of basic. Basic decency in him, I think. I think he believes in moderation, in those sort of British traditions. Even if in his actions he's actually quite a violent person. He's I think he disapproves of torture, I would say. Yeah.
Jeremy, yes. Your man is a traitor, basically. Yes. Shouldn't he be lined up and shot? I mean, what's he doing getting onto chapter two?
Yeah, he should be lined up and shot, and that's one of his fears, is that they may use the death penalty. They won't shoot him necessarily, but they may just sort of dump him somewhere.
And then just to explain, Paul Dark is shown to be a double agent in chapter one.
In the first chapter of my first novel, Free Agent, you sort of think, actually, he may, this is going to be perhaps a sort of James Bondy thing, perhaps a Le Carre thing. And then you realise his sort of M figure, his boss, says, you know, we've got another traitor, unfortunately. And you think that's going to be his mission. I hope you think that's going to be his mission, to sort of uncover the traitor. And the first chapter ends with him shooting his boss dead, and you realise he's the traitor. And that's basically the setup. And, I mean, I think I did get a lot of people when I was writing it, I was in a writer's group, saying, you know, you need to make him sympathetic and all that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know, I think maybe I'm very naive, but I think readers are more, it's more if he's interesting, you know, it's more if you're interested in following the character, and if he's an interesting human being. I think something I try to do is at certain points he is sympathetic, and I hope that I sort of lull readers, because it's told by him, that you're sort of starting to sympathise with him, and then suddenly he'll do something, and you'll realise, actually, hang on a minute, this guy's a traitor, and I should be hating him. So I'm trying to sort of keep readers on their toes quite a bit, that you're not quite sure whether or not you like him or not, and that it varies as the books, you know, while you're reading the books. And I just think that generally, I think you're absolutely right, that thrillers are morality tales, and the good and evil, you know, the fight between good and evil is what they're about. And for me, anyway, the fascinating thing is that good and evil can exist in the same person. So that he is, even though he's a traitor, somewhere he is a good man. He's just made the worst mistake ever as a young man, and he just cannot reverse this mistake. And I think, I'm hoping that readers would not sympathise with him, but to a degree understand the situation that he's in, and think, I could possibly have been in that situation, perhaps, if my life had gone the way that his life had gone. I may also have been duped, you know, and found myself in that situation, and then would I necessarily be evil? So I think that's really the question that I'm asking.
And you spend years with him. I mean, do you like him? Or sometimes do you...
I don't really like him, no. I don't really like him. I think I'm fascinated by him, and I find myself accessing his voice alarmingly easily sometimes. I'm worried about that. But no, I don't think he's a particularly likeable person. I think he's a very cold, very ruthless, selfish person. But he's a flawed human being, and I have affection for him, I would
say.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Adrian, Harry Tate is surrounded by people at MI5 who clearly are the bad guys. Is that
true? When his boss actually tried to have him eliminated by a hit squad because he was in danger of being scooped up by the Russians, when he was, I mean, just to give it very quickly, he was caught up in a drugs bust that went wrong. He was in control of it. And it wasn't long after the Jean-Charles de Menezes thing, and some civilians were shot dead in crossfire. So they thought, well, get him out of the way rather than have him found out by the press. And they sent him to this outpost in Georgia. That's where he was going to be shot dead. So he's actually fighting cynicism, because he got away along with other security services and MI6 burnouts who'd been sent to this outpost. He didn't realise that's what was being done, but he's fighting cynicism. So I haven't given him a huge number of flaws, because I want people to actually like him.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I channel Harry Tate, rather like him, but... I think I'd like to see him as a sympathetic character, and he's got the skills of having been in the army and then MI5, and I want to use those but still retain the link to the sort of espionage intelligence thing. So there's always that backdrop. So he's a loyal servant of the state, but
right. He's
fighting that cynicism to think, bugger me, they nearly killed me. But he wants to be still doing the right thing. So I think that. But he does have a few flaws, but one of them is bringing out a gun when he really gets annoyed.
And Rory, John Shakespeare, when you look at the Cold War, there's a clear ideological difference between the KGB and, you know, communism and what some people would say was the free world or capitalism. And nowadays, with the war on terror, you know, these people are trying to blow us up. In Elizabethan England, was it a question of doing your duty for Queen, or was it a question of we're fighting a war against the Spanish, or is it just someone's paying me some money to get this scalp? And then presumably John Shakespeare has slightly higher morals than that.
I think he does, yes. I found it very difficult to come up with, in the first instance, to come up with a hero who fitted into Walsingham's network without being totally disreputable. But what I came up with was the idea of this man who is Will Shakespeare's alter ego. He is like, he is a more prosaic Will Shakespeare. He has those values, which clearly people did have in those days, because Will Shakespeare was around in those days. But he had to work. He's very patriotic, actually. You say they're not patriotic. John Shakespeare is very patriotic.
And was the patriotism in those days?
Very
was,
much so, yeah. Yes, very much so, yeah. There's the idea of working for Queen and country, certainly. But he doesn't. He just doesn't like what's going on around him. He doesn't like the persecution of the Catholics. He doesn't like the use of, as I say, the use of torture, which was against the whole English spirit. For centuries, it had been outlawed. In fact, you could be, it was a felony to apply torture, and that wasn't revoked. And yet, in 1565, you had Sir Thomas Smith, who was a predecessor of Walsingham, saying, you know, one of the wonderful things about England is the way, you know, they're not scared of death, but they abhor torture and civility. 10 years later, you have, still in the Cold War, you have Walsingham writing to Cecil, Lord Burghley, saying, I know that without torture we will not prevail. And it was just introduced. There was no Act of Parliament to bring it in. It was just introduced and used, and it was used wholesale. And you say, how did they get the information? And I mentioned, you know, through money and through foreign diplomacy, their diplomat, but also through torture. They turned a lot of people through torture. They
what
made
kind
them
of torture did they use?
They used the rack. They used the hanging against the wall, which, you know, is a bit of a laugh when you see it in Monty Python, a guy hanging up there like that. But actually, it was reckoned to be one of the most painful tortures ever devised by a man. And the thing was that you couldn't prove there were no physical injuries on the person. Mm. And when Robert Southwell came to trial and he said he was tortured 10 times and 10 times worse than death. Topcliffe said, let him show me his wounds. And he very cleverly replied, Southwell, ask a woman to show me her throes. You know, that was the pain they were undergoing. Mm. It was very, very nasty. But so that's the world in which my hero has to work, and that's why I came up with
And were you reminded of Guantanamo when you were writing that? I mean, does that sort of get you upset or angry?
There was a concentration camp set up in Wisbeach, which is little known, in Wisbeach Castle, and they stuck a lot of Jesuits and seminary priests there. And it was one of the world's first internment or concentration camps.
Hmm.
A bit like Guantanamo. They're held there for many, many years, people there, without trial.
Gosh. Technology was important during the Cold War, but they had their sort of dead letter boxes and all that kind of thing. Obviously, technology, electronic technology, has improved dramatically in the last 20 or 30 years. Does that affect both modern spying and also the depiction of spying? Simon, do you have a view on that, or is it all basically the same thing?
Well, I think you the way that technology is moving, if you want to operate as a modern spy, you know, you need to be able to adapt it. So, for instance, in my book, they're constantly buying and getting rid of pay-as-you-go phones, for instance, or simply not communicating. You know, and so it was interesting about the death of Bin Laden. You know, how they identified that house was, you know, the various clues included the fact that there were no phone lines that went in there, and they burned their rubbish, which isn't typical in Abbottabad. So it's interesting, in order to operate as a fugitive, you have to sort of go back to the Stone Age. You know, you need to jettison all the technology. But at the same time, as a writer, you become aware of how much quicker everything becomes. So you definitely have to adapt to it and keep abreast of what's going on, certainly.
And Rory, presumably the quill pen was important. Couriers, what was sort of the quill technology pen of spying? Quill torture pen. you've talked about?
Hidden writing, using
invisible ink.
Juice, yeah. And a lot of codes. And
right.
The great code breaker of the day was Felipe's, who originally worked for Walsingham and later worked for the Earl of Essex. When Walsingham died, the Secret Service split. It split between Robert Cecil and Essex, who were sworn enemies of the 1590s. And sometimes working against each other rather than with each other.
Were those sort of substitution codes where A equals C, or were they more complicated?
There were substitution codes, and there were also all sorts of things like acrostics. And I'm not a code expert, but Simon Singh's written a very good book about all the codes used in the that were used when the exiled Catholics were communicating with Mary Queen of Scots, and how Felipe's broke these codes. Fascinating stuff. But I'm certainly not an expert. One of the things I was going to mention actually is the link between Walsingham. I mean, it seems like a very long way away, but it's a very clear link between Walsingham and today. In the 1920s, American historian Conyers Reed wrote a three-part biography of Walsingham. It's been the biggest biography ever written of him, actually, and he was the acknowledged expert. And he was a great admirer of Walsingham and his methods, which seem pretty dubious today. But actually, Conyers Reed was was one of the progenitors of the CIA.
Oh, really?
So you might see some of the methods coming through in the space of 300 years, 400 years.
Jeremy, is there anything that's been discovered in the last 20 years about Cold War technology that didn't come out at the time that you've been able to use?
Yes, I think the most fascinating example of that is during 1962. We now know that Oleg Penkovsky, who was a colonel in Soviet military intelligence, who volunteered to act as an agent in place for MI6 and the CIA, at a sort of crucial moment while the Cuban Missile Crisis was warming up and was handing over thousands and thousands of documents, and was really the most valuable agent the West has ever had. And while the crisis was kind of reaching, threatening levels of what you call, the danger of obliteration, his handlers in MI6 and CIA got worried, that something might really happen. And they said to Penkovsky, if you hear of an imminent Soviet launch against us, we're going to give you a way to signal, an emergency signal, to tell us that they're thinking of doing this, and call one of these numbers. And this has been revealed in the last 20 years. Mm. Call one of these numbers, let the phone be answered, then blow three times into the mouthpiece, put the phone down, wait exactly a minute, call back again and do the same thing. If you do that, then leave some information if you can in a dead drop about what's happening, and then we'll know, and it will go to the JIC and everything, and we'll decide whether or not we will launch our attack. And MI6 and CIA both got that call, and they had to decide what to do about it. And that's probably the closest we have come to nuclear war. Because this was there were enormous negotiations between the CIA and MI6 about exactly how we would deal with this signal. And they had decided if we receive this signal, there is a whole thing, and it will go to the JIC, it will go to the Prime Minister. And, this is a signal that the Russians are about to attack us. And they got the signal, and they decided not to act. And, in fact, Penkovsky had been captured by the KGB, and he had revealed the signal but had not told them, what the signal meant. The very real possibility is that Penkovsky basically thought, I've been captured. He was working because he hated the Soviet Union. Mm. He was very, very resentful of not being promoted and lots of other things. And in his first meeting with MI6 and CIA, he had said, these are the main defense installations in Moscow. If you give me some 20 portable nuclear weapons in suitcases, I will place them in those. This is in his first meeting. So it's very possible that what may have happened is that Penkovsky basically thought, I've been caught.
Let's blow up the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and of course it would have blown up the Soviet Union, but it also would have blown up London, Paris, Washington, and everywhere else. And so Gervase Cowell, who was the MI6 officer who received that call, had to make a judgment call. Do I now pass this on? And he very quietly decided, no, Penkovsky's been caught. And that man probably did stop us from going to nuclear war.
Gosh.
So I think that's quite an interesting example of technology being used during the Cold War.
Adrian, just quickly, any sort of nice bits of technology Harry uses?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all very useful. The pay-and-throw phones are in use, and he has a colleague called Rick who is a bit of a computer geek, so he can circumnavigate all of the various ways of finding out information about people. But a lot of the time, he's actually relying on tradecraft, which is, he goes looking for people in book two. Who don't want to be found, so he has to look through their rubbish.
This is traces, isn't it?
That's right, in traces. Yeah. He has to look through their rubbish to find out any clue he can about where they might have gone. So, you know, they've gone off the grid, there's no electronic trail that he can use. And in the third book, Rick again resources to Facebook to actually finding out, you know, where people might be. So these things are great fun for us because we can write about them because we can drop them whenever we don't want to.
I was just quickly, I was at a defense conference with the Pentagon about a year ago, and there were some fairly senior people there talking about the future. And they basically said, with the miniaturization of drones, privacy is over. There will be a point at which these things are so easy to manufacture and they will be so small that following anyone, be it you know, the paparazzi following a celebrity or following a spy, a diplomat or whatever else, that it's not going to be long before any notion of privacy is pretty much defunct. And that's going to have, I think, fairly significant repercussions for how we write.
Well, we've got time for a few questions. There's some books here for the best ones. First question.
Right, okay. The question is aimed at all four of you. In Casino Royale, there's a place where Daniel Craig, i.e. James Bond, is sat naked on a chair where they've removed the cane seat and the guy's whacking him. He's sort of giggling, going, oh, I've got an itch, you know, and oh, a bit to the right, and a bit, and then he says something about, now you're the one who's scrapped so-and-so's body. Now, they took that scene out when they put it on the television. My question is there a scene in your book where your reader will be chuckling and appalled at the same time?
Adrian, would you like to answer that?
Thanks a lot. God, you caught me there. I can't think of one, but there must be. I mean, because there are always moments where you actually want to write a scene that both shocks people but actually makes them shiver at the same time, but also a little bit of a chuckle, I guess. You've got to have them interested in the scene you're writing. So there's a kind of borderline case, and I can't, right off ahead, my head's gone blank. I can't really think of anything at the moment, but it's sure to be there. Read the books, you'll find one.
Simon?
I think it depends how dark your sense of humour is. Yeah. I mean, Jonah, in my second book, Rage, is strung up and electrocuted several times with a sort of classic, kind of, you know, the bits of wire coming out of the wall jabbed into him, and he has a bit of kind of repartee with his torturer. So yeah, no, I think maybe there are bits there. You have to look, see. Bye,
Jeremy.
I think I have a scene in my second novel where he, Paul Dark, is tortured in a kind of futuristic for the time cell, and there is some kind of ironic humour, and it's influenced by Casino Royale. But just slightly not to answer your question, I a few months ago discovered a screenplay of Casino Royale that was written in the 60s by Ben Hecht, the great American screenwriter of Notorious and many other films, and it never got made. But I was amazed to see that in that script that he'd written in 1964, that he actually had that torture scene, because it's in the novel, and it's extremely graphic, and it's actually very similar to the way that Daniel Craig played it. And although you can really see Connery saying the lines, and there's one where he says to him, to Le Chiffre, who's torturing him, in this particular way, he says, up your gizzard, you fat pimp. and you know, in the same way that you sympathise with Daniel Craig, I think it's the same concept. And I suspect, I can't think off the top of my head, but I suspect if you go back, perhaps Borat will know, but I suspect that kind of humour, that dark humour of you know, sort of brutal interrogation, brutal violence, being countered by the hero in a kind of bravado way with humour is probably very old. I mean, it's probably, I don't think Fleming invented it. I think it's probably a very old tradition that we respond to that the hero is going to kind of, he's completely stripped bare and he's got nothing there and the villains have got him. But nevertheless, you know, he's still got, you know, something. He's still got his fight in him.
Rory?
I think that's certainly true. Sforzarelli, on the Davis execution, he stood and chatted with the executioner and addressed the crowd, and he ran his finger along the axe and said, "That's a sharp medicine, but it'll cure all my ills today." And, you know, they were expected to have a good laugh when they went rich. And people were judged by how they went to their deaths, very much.
Did you have a good one-liner?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay, next question. Sally.
Pure testosterone, right? Given that the majority of readers in the UK are women, had it occurred to any of you to have your main protagonist as a female?
Rory.
Start with you. I have some very strong women in my books, but it would be very difficult to have a woman as the protagonist, I think. In those days, I think.
Jeremy, sorry, we'll try.
Ditto, really. I mean, Stella Remington's here, I know, but I think in the Cold War, especially in the 60s, there were very few female MI6 agents. One of my favourite agents is spy characters is Modesty Blaise, who's absolutely terrific. So I think, you know, it can be done, you know.
Simon, I mean, you have one, really, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, the A Loyal Spy is told from two different perspectives, one character, Jonas Said, and the other one, Miranda Abdel-Aswad. And so yes, and the book that I'm just writing at the moment also has a female character. I mean, I think it's an interesting challenge. I don't know whether I'd have a book with solely one, just one woman's perspective, but maybe. I mean, it might be worth a try.
Because it's just that I'm quite good mates with Graham Hurley, and his publisher's told him to get rid of the helicopter on the front to make it appeal to women more.
I had that with my first book. We agreed we wouldn't put a gun on the cover because it would put women off. But then it actually does have a gun on the cover.
Adrian?
Before writing Red Station, I wrote 5 crime novels with a female protagonist as the main lead. And I'd written lots of stories for women's magazines with women as the only protagonist. So I made a conscious decision not to have one as the main lead, but there is.
You've already done it.
Yeah, I've already done it, but there is an MI6 agent and another burnout who does nasty things with a powder compact with a blade concealed in it. So she was in book one, she's coming back in book three, so, you know, you can sort of tamper down a bit of the testosterone by bringing in a bit of the other thing. I can't remember the name of it now, but there you go.
And one last question with a very quick answer. The man in the back with the white shirt? Well, not you then.
Anyway, I'm just wondering if in the course of your researches you ever come across material that you'd dearly like to use but can't, either because of how you discover it or because of the consequences of publicising it.
Okay, and I'm afraid just a one-sentence answer, Adrian.
Yes, stuff you do use, or rather you want to use, but it actually might be either unseemly or it would cause complications with the rest of the plot, but
I was thinking outside the book, not you can't use it within the book, but the consequences outside the book.
Oh, right. If I had, I couldn't talk about it.
And you'd have to kill him.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Is that the whole lot of them?
Yeah.
So,
in A Loyal Spy, one of the characters describes how you take out MI6 in the book. I had an office that was very close to MI6. I used to walk past it every day, and I spent quite a lot of time thinking about how on earth you would assault the place. And it's described in there what the weaknesses are. But I'm assuming that somebody somewhere might have read it and given it a bit of thought to how they might improve some of their security procedures.
Jeremy?
I haven't had that problem yet, but I love finding out secret information that no one else knows. You know, so I'm a bit curiosity killed the cat, perhaps, but I haven't had the problem yet.
and
no,
Rory.
I haven't had that problem.
No, you wouldn't really, would you? That was an honest answer anyway. Okay, well, thank you very much. Before you go, I have a box of books to deliver. I think to the spanking question is the Priscilla.